Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World is the book that we are talking about this morning with the author Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony, I think we might move now to Afghanistan and Pakistan, the chapter that you title The War Economy. Can you talk about PMCs, private military companies?
War has been privatised since year dot. If one goes back in history, one sees routinely, it's often not called what it's called now, but armies of various empires routinely paid corporations, what they weren't corporations back then, but private interest to assist them in their war effort. So it's been going on forever. However, 9/11 has changed this. The Bush administration had a view that war should be massively outsourced to private corporations. So 9/11 happens, they go into Afghanistan in October 2001, they go into Iraq in March 2003, and the use of private corporations, the most infamous Halliburton, Blackwater, were often given huge contracts without tender to not just manage a situation, but often to run militias. Halliburton was doing everything from providing meals to US soldiers in Iraq to various other acts. The problem with this has become, and Australia's doing this too, although not to quite the same extent, is that governments are so, if they're determined to go to war in the first place, it's far easier from their perspective to use a private company often to do things they don't want the state to do. So in Vietnam, for example, the idea that you would have huge billion-dollar corporations running parts of the war was unthinkable. Now, I mean, the Vietnam War was a complete disaster and a war crime on a massive scale. But what's changed is that governments have made a decision. The Bush administration, the Obama administration's continued this. The Australian government of various stripes has a similar view as well. Is that what I found when I was there? That you have all these former soldiers, U.S. Army, British Army, countless other armies who are looking to make more money. They're able to be hired by private security firms. They are then employed by a range of other assets to do anything from guarding a compound to, sometimes far more concerningly, to run some kind of... one of the things that has happened in the last years in Afghanistan is something called night raids, people may have heard of, where you have a situation where US Army, Australian Army, goes into a village in the middle of nowhere, says there are terrorists here who are shooting us tomorrow, yesterday, whenever, we need to find these insurgents and get rid of them. The problem with this has become that a lot of the intelligence that they are using, so-called intelligence, is coming from private intelligence firms. So when you have private intelligence firms that are giving information, they have a reason to give certain kinds of information because they're for profit. And one of the things that I found speaking to many people there was that that information is so profoundly wrong, and the effect of that is that a lot of innocent people are taken and killed and captured and imprisoned. And what do you think that does? That, of course, enriches an insurgency. So it's a constantly evolving, destructive beast. And one of the issues that I think people are maybe not quite as aware of in Afghanistan today, for example, there are roughly 60 to 80,000 US troops, which are going to start being drawn down by Obama in the next year and a half. But there are over 100,000 contractors, private contractors. Now, they're not all security. Some of them are, you know, some Bangladeshi dude making a meal for a US soldier. Contractors will stay in that country. And what people often don't know is when Obama pulled out troops from Iraq a few years ago in 2011, there were countless private security firms that were left there. And in Afghanistan, it's likely to be the same thing. So the occupation is rebranded. The argument you'll read in the press next year here in Australia and the US will be the war's over. Obama will declare victory, which would be hilarious because the war was lost arguably in 2001, and we'll just move on, you know.
But then what sort of control will the Australian government have in that country?
Well, little. I mean, one of the things that's so disturbing is in Uruzgan province, which is where the Australian troops have been based for many years, we have partnered up with some of the worst warlords imaginable. And one of the things that people often talk about, certainly those who supported the war in 2001 and even now say, and it's a legitimate question, how about the women of Afghanistan? How about the fact that women were treated unbelievably appallingly under the Taliban? Totally true. What does it mean when the West pulls out? Will women, girls who have in some areas some benefits, they can go to school in some areas, will that mean that that won't happen anymore? And it's a legitimate question with no simple answer. The truth is that there are risks about what would happen if US troops potentially pull out. However, It's a false question in a way, because it ignores the fact that what the US has been doing for now 12 years is partnering up in the vast parts of the country with the worst warlords, who weren't helping girls or women. They're enriching themselves and causing carnage wherever they were. So what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan was basically pay off our enemies to stop them shooting at us. That's what the so-called awakening was in Iraq, when there was a massive, crazy, out-of-control civil war, quasi-genocidal civil war in Iraq, 2005 to 2007. The reason violence reduced, although it's still off the chart, was we were paying off our former al-Qaeda enemies to be nice to us. That's basically what our war became. In Afghanistan, it was similar, different but similar. And the private aspect to it is that Australia's influence in Afghanistan was always minimal at best. Our influence, once our troops would pull out, will be even less than minimal, so whatever word that is, close to useless. And but worse, the legacy that we leave there is a terrible one. I mean, I think Australia, having spent 12 years occupying the country, has a responsibility to do something. And I think we can, if we do it cleverly, deliver very targeted aid to help certain groups or individuals. The problem has been that so much of our support has been so tied to our military. So when you have a situation where troops are delivering aid, when too often that, I think, has become the way in which the US also delivers its aid, person X in small village in Afghanistan sees aid intimately tied to a soldier, to a militarized force. And the problem with that is, therefore, that aid groups are potentially compromised because they're partnering up with an army. Now, aid groups often will say in response, we simply can't get access to certain places security-wise because the country is at war. And that's true to an extent. But a lot of aid groups like Medecins Sans Frontières, MSF, has made the decision, in my view, a correct one, that they won't operate in areas where they actually have to deliver aid by a soldier. That simply fundamentally goes against what aid should be about. But that slippage has happened a lot with the Australian and American governments. And I think, unfortunately, what the US is likely to do there is to replace a lot of soldiers with private security and private intelligence and CIA operatives to allow themselves kind of a forward base, so to speak, to tackle terrorism, without realizing that when you look at, say, Iraq, here we are 2 years after the US pulled out of Iraq, and the country is back in civil war again. And I'm not saying it's America's solely fault. I mean, it's a complicated situation. But I think we too often have this weird sense in the West that, well, that war's over, you know, let's move on.
Mm.
People there can't move on because they're living a tough life.
And there's rarely any will from Western governments to put some of these services back into public hands. Is it just too much down the slippery slope now that we could never go back to actually having services delivered by the very people that need those services? You know, things like health and education and aid. And
yeah, I think the problem has... Yeah, the short answer is yes. It's become a very difficult conversation to have. I mean, the idea, for example, just to bring it back briefly to Australia, to put all detention centres back in public hands, I don't say that if it was in public hands tomorrow, the system would be perfect and utopian. Of course it wouldn't. There'd be problems just by very nature of having a lot of people locked up in different detention is going to be a problem, whether it's run by a private or the state. But I think there needs to be a greater discussion and pushback, both from the public but also in the corporate press. I mean, I talk about in the book, as I have in much of my work over the years, that the corporate press has a lot to answer for, that there is almost a sense in many parts of the media there's little or no questioning of this kind of agenda. There are obviously certain writers who now and then might write a column saying, oh, isn't it terrible that Serco earns so much money? It is delivering a terrible service. That's true, but there's little or no discussion that actually questions the economic system that allows that in the first place. I think too many journalists, and I speak as a journalist myself, but too many journalists see themselves as part of a system. They benefit from that system. They want to be close and within. Almost they'd like to, how do I put this subtly, they like to be on the corporate teat, and it tastes good. You just suck on that teat and it tastes pretty good. And the reason I say that is because journalists, I think to me, journalists are either insiders or outsiders. And look at a show like The Insiders on ABC TV, which fundamentally goes against what journalism should be, in my humble view. I've never been invited on there, can't imagine why. But I think it's a problem that journalists sort of proudly show themselves to be living in a bubble and repeating talking points they've heard from someone within that bubble. And that really, I think, is exactly the same with the embedding process, where embedding is not just journalist X going with US soldiers in Afghanistan and seeing what they're doing. It's embedding psychologically and choosing to live within an environment where you are generally not questioning the power that is around you.
And that's a really good example of how the war was privatized absolutely from the start. That at the start, they decided which journalists they were going to take with them to garner, you know, favorable coverage.
Yes.
It is through publications, I think, like Crikey, where you wrote about the detention centers on your on your trip when you were on that journey, and through New Matilda, where you also write, and where Paul Farrell, who you mentioned in the book, who you worked with on the detention logs.
He's a good friend of mine. There's more stuff coming from him and I.
Yeah,
as well,
which we've spoken about on this show too. An incredible resource of information to be found there on the treatment of asylum seekers by Australia. I have been speaking with Anthony Lowenstein on his book Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. It's from the first page of this book, I was so angry right from the start. It is an incredible collection of condensed material. You know, you can find a lot of this sort of stuff out if you read your work and other people's work around Australia, but it's a really great, intense way of seeing how vulture capitalism is working across the world and also how Australia is implicit in that. Anthony, so thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
And good luck with the book tour.
Thank you.